We stayed at the inn in Rami 4 nights. It didn't take Ameno long to let me know she knew Mele wasn't a boy, but she asked no questions. It was clear enough why a girl might want to travel as a boy, and dropped no hints to anyone else. Mele wasn't sick, but she'd been pretty near giving out. 3 days of rest and good food and kind care did wonders for her. She sat in bed and carefully sewed our gold pieces into our clothing, and then slept again. I would have stayed on still longer to build her up for travel if it hadn't been for what I heard the 4th night at the inn. Men of the town came in every evening for a glass of beer or cider and to chat with one another and with any guests at the inn who wanted to be sociable. They were a bit cautious and stiff with me at first, because I was supposed to be a scholar and a city man. But seeing that I wasn't much more than a boy and spoke little and modestly, they soon ignored me in a friendly fashion. They talked about local affairs, of course, but the travelers among them made conversation about the wider world, too, which was interesting to me, who had been for so long in the forest and the marshes, hearing nothing of the city-states and Bendeley. Mele was sleeping sound after a good supper, and I came to sit at the common room fire. Conversation had fallen on the Barnavites. Everybody had a story about Barna's men, who used to raid the roads and farms and market towns. Some were the old romantic tales I'd heard in Etra. But one man here confirmed them. He said that 3 years ago, raiders had taken half the flock he was driving to market, but they'd truly taken half his flock, counting them out, one for you, one for us, when they could as well have taken them all. And so, he said, he could only curse them with half a curse. I had the impression that his hearers half believed him, too. Then they all had tales about Barna's city, how the slaves kept houses full of beautiful women, how they had so much stolen gold there that they used it for roofing, and when the soldiers burned the city, molten gold ran in streams in the gutters. Everybody knew about Barna, the giant with flaming red hair, taller than any other man, who'd planned to attack Ascion, make himself king of Bendeley, and put the slaves to rule their fallen masters. There was some discussion of the fact that you never could trust a slave, no matter how loyal he seemed, and several examples of slavish treachery were given. "Well, here's a tale for you," said one of the guests of the inn, a wool buyer from eastern Bendeley, "about a disloyal slave and a loyal one, too. I just heard this one. There was a slave boy from the marshes who'd been the pride of his masters in the city of Etra. He could tell any tale or sing any song, no matter what. He knew them all. He was worth 100 gold pieces to his masters. He defiled a daughter of the house and ran away, stealing a bag of gold with him. They set out slave takers after him, but none found him, and some said he drowned. But the son of the house had a royal slave who swore he'd find the boy and bring him back to Etra to take his punishment for shaming the house of his masters. So he got on the track, and after a while he heard word of a young runaway in Barna's city, who was famous for his speaking and singing. Barna himself, having been a learned slave, set a great value on this boy. But before the soldiers came, the boy gave Barna the slip too, and vanished again. The slave is still hunting for him. I talked to a man who knows him. He calls him Three Eyebrows. He's been to the marshes, and to Kasikar, and Piram, and says he'll hunt the runaway down if it takes him the rest of his life. Now there's a slave loyal to his masters, I say." The others expressed modified approval. I tried to imitate their judicious nods, while the heart in me was cold as a lump of ice. My pose of being a scholar, which I hoped would save me from suspicion, now looked likely to bring it upon me. If only the man hadn't said the runaway was from the marshes. My looks, the color of my skin, always drew some notice anywhere outside the marshes, and sure enough, a townsman eyed me over his beer and said, You look to be from that side of the country. Do you know anything about this famous slave, then? I couldn't speak. I shook my head with as much indifference as I could pretend. More stories of escapes and slave takers followed. I sat through them, drank my cider, and told myself that I must not panic, that nobody had questioned my story, that having the child with me would avert suspicion. Tomorrow we'd set off again. It had been a mistake to stay anywhere for any length of time. But then Mela could never have gone on if we hadn't rested here. It would be all right. We would come to the second river in only a few days, and cross it, and be free. I spoke with Ameno that night, asking if she knew of any carters going north that might give us a lift. She told me where to go. Early in the morning, I routed sleepy Mela out. Ameno sent us off with a pack of food and took the silver piece I offered her. "Luck be with you. Go with Anu," she said, and gave Mela a long, grave embrace. We went off through the foggy dawn to a yard on the far edge of town where carters met to make up their loads and sometimes find passengers. And there we found a ride as far as a place called Tertudi, which the carter said was halfway to the river. I had no clear map of this part of Bendeley in my mind, and had to rely on what people told me, knowing only that the river was north of us, and Mesun across it, and well to the east. It took our carter's slow horses all day to get to Tertudi, a small, poor town with no inn. I didn't want to stay there and be noticed. I hoped to break any connection with the inn at Rami, to leave no traceable path behind us. We spoke to no one in Tertudi, but simply walked away from it for a couple of miles into the hayfields that surrounded it, and made ourselves a camp by a little stream for the night. Crickets sang all about us in the warm evening, near and far. Mela ate with a good appetite and said she wasn't tired. She wanted me to tell her a story she knew. That was her request. "Tell me a story I know." I told her the beginning of the Chamhan. She listened, intent, never moving, till at last she began to blink and yawn. She fell asleep curled up in her poncho, holding the little cat figure at the base of her throat. I lay listening to the crickets and looking out for the first stars. I slipped into sleep peacefully, but woke in the dark. There was a man in the hayfield, standing watching us. I knew him. I knew his face. The scar that split his eyebrow. I tried to get up, but I was paralyzed, as I had been paralyzed by Dorod's drugs. I couldn't move, and my heart pounded and pounded. It was deep night. The stars blazing. Most of the crickets had fallen silent, but one still trilled nearby. No one was there. But I could not sleep again. It grieved me that blind hate and rancor should be my last link to Archimonde. I could think now of the people of that house with gratitude for what they had given me, kindness, security, learning, love. I could never think that Sotur or Yavin had or would have betrayed my love. I was able to see, in part at least, why the mother and father had betrayed my trust. The master lives in the same trap as the slave, and may find it even harder to see beyond it. But Torm and his slave double, Hobi, never wanted to look beyond it. They valued nothing but power, the most brutal control of other people. My escape, if he heard of it, would have rankled Torm bitterly. As for Hobi, always seething with envious hatred, the knowledge that I was going about as a free man would goad him to rageful, vengeful pursuit. I had no doubt that he was on my trail, and I was deeply afraid of him. By myself, I was no match for him, and now I had my little helpless hostage with me. She would awaken all his cruelty. I knew that cruelty.